Our moderator tonight is John Leonard. He is the Chair of Religious Studies at Edgewood College. So I'm going to have him come up and he will introduce the program. Thank you.
Good evening and welcome again. The Faith and Reason series is quite a production, as you could see from the brochures, the posters that have been out. And it certainly has attracted a lot of attention immediately as soon as it came out. So I'm glad to see so many people are out tonight. Our speakers tonight, as you know from the posters, are Chris Hedges and Marshall O'Nellian. Chris, as you know, the author of the book that's for sale, and several of his texts are for sale tonight, graduated from seminary at Harvard Divinity School and was foreign correspondent for nearly two decades for the New York Times and other publications. He was part of the team of reporters at the New York Times that won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of global terrorism. Chris is the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and Losing Moses on the Freeway, The Ten Commandments in America, among other texts. The second speaker is Marshall O'Nellian, who is professor of physics at the UW here, born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He was an Eagle Scout at 13, a U.S. Air Force officer, and has been at the UW since 1987. Marshall lives in Stoughton and is the author, along with another speaker in our series, whom you will meet in the coming weeks, of Seeking Truth, Living with Doubt. Please welcome our speakers and enjoy the evening.
Well, thank you very much. I grew up in a farm town in upstate New York, where my life and the life of my family centered on the Presbyterian Church. I prayed and sang hymns every Sunday, went to Bible school, listened to my father preach the weekly sermon, and attended seminary, as you heard, at Harvard Divinity School to be a preacher myself. America was a place where things could be better if we worked to make them better, and where our faith saved us from despair, self-righteousness, and the dangerous belief that we knew or could carry out the will of God. We were taught that those who claimed to speak for God, the self-appointed prophets who promised the kingdom of God on earth, were dangerous. We had no ability to understand God's will. We were taught we did the best we could. We trusted and had faith in the mystery, the unknown before us. We made decisions, even decisions that on the outside looked moral, well aware of the numerous motives, some good and some bad, that went into every human act. In the end, we all stood in need of forgiveness. We were all tainted by sin. None were pure. The Bible was not the literal word of God. It was not a self-help manual that could predict the future. It did not tell us how to vote or allow us to divide the world into us and them, the righteous and the damned, the infidels and the blessed. It was a book written by a series of ancient writers, certainly fallible, and at times at odds with each other, who asked the right questions and struggled with the mystery and transcendence of human existence. There was no alcohol in the manse where I grew up. Indeed, my father invested huge amounts of energy in a quixotic attempt to shut down the glass bar, the one bar in town, and railed against the drinking in the VFW hall. We did not work on the Sabbath. I never heard my father swear. But coupled with this piety was a belief that as Christians, we were called to fight for justice. My father took an early stand in the town in support of the civil rights movement, a position that was highly unpopular in rural white enclaves where Dr. Martin Luther King was one of the most hated men in America. A veteran of World War II, he opposed the Vietnam War, telling me when I was about 12 that if the war was still being waged and I was 18 and drafted, he would go to prison with me. And to this day, I carry in my head the rather gloomy image of sitting in a jail cell with my dad. Finally, because his youngest brother was gay, he understood the pain of being a gay man in America. He worked in the latter part of his life in the gay rights movement, calling for the ordination and marriage of gays. When he found that my college had no gay and lesbian organization, he brought gay speakers to Colgate. The meetings led to gays and lesbians confiding in him that they felt uncomfortable coming out of the closet to start an open gay and lesbian organization. A problem my father swiftly solved by taking me out to lunch and informing me, although I was not gay, that I had to found it. When I went into the dining hall for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, the checker behind the desk would take my card, mark off the appropriate box, and hand it back to me, saying, "Faggot." I made it my undergraduate mission to seduce his girlfriend. This willingness on the part of my father to take a moral stand, to accept risk and ridicule, was, he showed me, the cost of the moral life. The Bible informed his life, as it has informed mine, but it never occurred to him to treat it as the literal word of God. The writers of the book of Genesis, who wrote about the creation of the world in 6 days, knew nothing, he told us, about the process of creation. They believed the earth was flat, with rivers above and below us. They wrote that God created light on the first day and the sun on the fourth day. Genesis was not written to explain the process of creation. It was written to help explain the purpose of creation. It was written to help us grasp a spiritual truth, not a scientific or historical fact. And this purpose, this spiritual truth, is something the writers did know about. The biblical writers, at their best, understood our divided natures. They knew our internal conflicts and battles, how we could love our brother and yet hate him, the oppressive power of parents, even the best of parents, the impulses that drive us to commit violations against others, the yearning to lead a life of meaning, our fear of mortality, our struggles to deal with our uncertainty, our loneliness, our greed, our lust, our ambition, our desires to be God, as well as our moments of nobility, compassion, and courage. They knew these emotions and feelings were entangled. They understood our weaknesses and our strengths. They understood how we are often not the people we want to be or know we should be. How hard it is for us to articulate all this, and how life and creation can be as glorious and beautiful as it can be mysterious, evil, and cruel. It is why Genesis is worth reading. Indeed, why the Bible stands as one of the great ethical and moral documents of our age. The biblical writers have helped shape and define Western civilization. Not to know the Bible, in some ways, is to be illiterate, to neglect the very roots of much that has informed our philosophy, art, literature, poetry, and music. It is to fall into a dangerous provincialism, as myopic and narrow as that embraced by those who say everything in the Bible is literally true and we do not need any other kind of intellectual inquiry. Doubt and belief are not, as biblical literalists claim, incompatible. Those who act without doubt are frightening. There lives more faith and honest doubt, Tennyson wrote, believe me, than in half the creeds. This was my faith. It is a pretty good summary of my faith today. God is inscrutable, mysterious, unknowable. We do not know or understand what life is about, what it means, why we are here, or what will happen to us after our brief sojourn on the planet ends. We are saved in the end by faith. Faith and trust that life is not meaningless and random, that there is a purpose to human existence, and that in the midst of this morally neutral universe, acts of compassion and blind human kindness, especially to those labeled our enemies and strangers, sustain the divine spark, which is love. These small acts of compassion have a power that lives after us. They are deeply subversive to all totalitarian creeds, which seek to thwart love outside of the small circle of believers. Through these acts, we recognize and affirm the humanity of the other, of the stranger, an affirmation which undermines the absolute control of totalitarian masters. Those who struggle to live the moral life and are able to sacrifice for others, even at great cost, stand as constant witnesses in our lives to this love, even long after they are gone. In the Gospels, this is called resurrection. Faith presupposes that we cannot know. We can never know. Those who claim to know what life means play God. These false prophets, clutching the cross and the Bible, offer, like Mephistopheles, to lead us back to a mythical paradise and an impossible, unachievable happiness and security, at once seductive and empowering. These self-appointed prophets, who saturate the airwaves, ask us to hand over moral choice and responsibility to them. They will tell us what is right and wrong in the eyes of God. They will tell us how to act, how to live. And in this process, they elevate themselves above us. They remove the anxiety of moral choice, the fundamental anxiety of human existence. This is part of their attraction. They give us the rules by which we live. But once we hand over this anxiety and accept their authority, we become enslaved. They become idols, and idols, as the Bible never ceases to tell us, destroy us. This is the battle underway in America. Should those who have raised themselves to the status of idols, men who preach that they know the will of God and can build a Christian America, achieve the power they seek, America, as we know it, will be destroyed. I saw enough of the world over the past 2 decades, for although I graduated from seminary, I was not ordained, and worked in Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and the Balkans as a foreign correspondent, to grasp that men and women of great moral probity and courage arise in all cultures, all nations, and all religions, to challenge the oppressor and fight for the oppressed. I also saw how the dominant religions of these nations were often twisted and distorted by totalitarian movements, turned into civic religions, where the goals of the movement or the state became the goals of the divine. The wars I covered were often fought in the name of one God or another. All, in fact, mocked the faith they purported to defend. America and the Christian religion have no monopoly on goodness or saintliness. God has not chosen us as a people above others. Our religious beliefs are as flawed and imperfect as all religious beliefs. But the best of American democracy and the best of the Christian religion embodies important values, values such as compassion, tolerance, a belief in justice and equality. America is a nation where all have a voice and a say in how they live and how they are governed. That we have never fully achieved these goals is a given, but our health as a country is determined by our steadfastness in striving to attain them. These values, democratic and Christian, are being dismantled by a movement that has appropriated the language and moral arguments from evangelicals, fundamentalists, and American patriots. But they are distinct from traditional evangelicals and fundamentalists in that they seek to use religion as a route to political power. This movement, properly called Dominionism or Christian Reconstructionism, is a radical mutation. It argues that American Christians have been mandated by God to rule, and it has many similarities with classical fascist movements. What the desperate sects that make up this movement share is an obsession with political power. Dominionists preach that Jesus has called on them to build the kingdom of God on earth. America becomes, in this militant biblicalism, an agent of God, and all political and intellectual opponents of America's Christian leaders are viewed, quite simply, as agents of Satan. Under Christian dominion, America will no longer be a sinful and fallen nation, but one in which the Ten Commandments will form the basis of our legal system. Aside from its proselytizing, the federal government will be reduced to the protection of property rights and homeland security. Some dominionists would further require all citizens to pay tithes to church organizations empowered by the government to run our social welfare agencies, and a number of influential figures advocate the death penalty for a host of moral crimes, including adultery, sodomy, apostasy, blasphemy, and witchcraft. The only legitimate voices in this state will be Christian. All others will be silenced. The engine that drives the radical Christian right in the United States, the most dangerous mass movement in American history, is not religiosity, but despair. It is a movement built on the growing personal and economic despair of tens of millions of Americans who have watched helplessly as their communities were plunged into poverty by the flight of manufacturing jobs, their families and neighborhoods torn apart by neglect and indifference, and who eventually lost hope that America was a place where they had a future. This despair crosses economic boundaries, of course, enveloping many in the middle class who live trapped in huge, soulless exurbs, where lacking any form of community rituals or centers, they also feel deeply isolated, vulnerable, and lonely. Those in despair are the most easily manipulated by demagogues who promise a fantastic utopia, whether it is a workers' paradise, fraternité, égalité, liberté, or the second coming of Jesus Christ. Those in despair search desperately for a solution, the warm embrace of a community to replace the one they lost, a sense of purpose and meaning, the assurance they are protected, loved, worthwhile. During the past 2 years of work on this book, I kept encountering this deadly despair. Driving down a highway lined with gas stations, fast food restaurants, and dollar stores, I often got vertigo, forgetting for a moment if I was in Detroit or Kansas City or Cleveland. There are parts of the United States, including whole sections of former manufacturing centers such as Ohio, that resemble the developing world, with boarded up storefronts, dilapidated houses, pothole streets, and crumbling schools. The end of the world is no longer an abstraction to many Americans. We have turned our backs on the working class, with much of the worst assaults, such as NAFTA and welfare reform, which saw a million Americans thrown off of welfare rolls, pushed through during President Clinton's Democratic administration. We stand passively and watch an equally pernicious assault on the middle class. Anything that can be put on software, from architecture to engineering to finance, can be outsourced, handed to workers overseas, but will be paid a third of what their American counterparts receive, and who will, like some 47 million Americans, have no access to health insurance or benefits. There has been, along with the rise of an American oligarchy, a steady Weimarization of the American working class. The top 1% of American households now has more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. This figure alone should terrify all who care about our democracy. As Plutarch reminded us, an imbalance between the rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. The stories believers told me of their lives before they found Christ were heartbreaking. These chronicles were about terrible pain, severe financial difficulties, struggles with addictions, or childhood sexual or physical abuse, profound alienation, and often thoughts about suicide. They were chronicles without hope. The real world betrayed them. They hated this world. And they willingly walked out on this world for the mythical world offered by these radical preachers. A world of magic. A world where God had a divine plan for them and intervened on a daily basis to protect them and perform miracles in their lives. The rage many expressed to me towards those who challenged this belief system was a rage born of fear. The fear of being plunged back into a reality-based world where these magical props would no longer exist, where they would once again be adrift, abandoned, and alone. And these Americans, tens of millions of them, now lie locked in the hermetic, closed systems of indoctrination provided by Christian schools, Christian homeschooling, and Christian radio and television. They receive all of their news, health and beauty tips, entertainment, and spiritual guidance through this twisted ideological prism. Hannah Arendt wrote in The Origins of Totalitarianism of this drive by all totalitarian movements to shut followers off from the real world. Before they seize power and establish a world according to their doctrines, she wrote, totalitarian movements conjure up a lying world of consistency, which is more adequate to the needs of the human mind than reality itself, in which, through sheer imagination, uprooted masses can feel at home and are spared the never-ending shocks which real life and real experiences deal to human beings and their expectations. The force possessed by totalitarian propaganda, before the movements have the power to drop iron curtains to prevent anyone's disturbing by the slightest reality the gruesome quiet of an entirely imaginary world, lies in its ability to shut the masses off from the real world. Dominionists now control most of America's major evangelical organizations, including nearly all Christian radio and television stations and denominations such as the Southern Baptist Convention. But Christians who challenge dominionists, even if they are fundamentalist or conservative or born again, are ruthlessly thrust aside. The marriage between these religious radicals and the neoconservatives, who seek to further unfetter corporations and remove the federal government from the task of regulating industry or taking care of the poor, has seen the movement make huge inroads into the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of American government. They stand poised to reshape and refashion American society. If they succeed, however, it will not be due to their ruthlessness and mendacity, or their callous manipulation of the people they lure into their movement, many of whom live on the margins of American society. It will be because of the moral failure of those who understand them, yet fail to confront them. The leading American institutions, tasked with defending tolerance and liberty, from the mainstream church to the great research universities to the Democratic Party to the press, have failed us. This is the awful paradox of tolerance. There arise moments when those who would destroy the tolerance that makes an open society possible can no longer be tolerated. They must be held accountable by those institutions tasked with maintaining the free exchange of ideas, mutual respect, liberty, and tolerance. They must be denied the right to demonize whole segments of American society as manipulated by Satan and worthy only of conversion or eradication. They must be made to treat their opponents with mutual respect and acknowledge the right of a fair hearing, even as they are free to disagree with their opponents. This passivity in the face of the Christian right threatens the health of the republic. and the movement is picking off the last remaining obstacles to their systems of indoctrination, mounting a fierce campaign to defeat hate crimes legislation, knowing that the courts could apply it to them as they spew hate talk over the radio, television, and internet about immigrants, gays, lesbians, liberals, and all those they brand as secular humanists. Despotic movements harness the power of modern communications to keep their followers locked in these closed systems. If this long, steady poisoning of the civil discourse is not challenged, if this movement continues to teach neighbor to hate neighbor, eventually the civil society in America will collapse. The Christian broadcasters, along with Christian schools and colleges, are indoctrinating and inciting followers in the name of Christ and American values to tear apart the nation. They preach, in short, civil war. Karl Popper, in the first volume of The Enemies of the Open Society, writes of this paradox of tolerance. Unlimited tolerance, he says, must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. If we extend unlimited tolerance, even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. In this formulation, I do not imply, for instance, that we should always suppress the utterance of intolerant philosophies. As long as we can counter them by rational argument and keep them in check by public opinion, suppression would certainly be most unwise. But we should claim the right to suppress them, if necessary by force, for it may easily turn out that they are not prepared to meet us on the level of rational argument, but begin by denouncing all argument. They may forbid their followers to listen to rational argument because it is deceptive, and teach them to answer arguments by the use of their fists or pistols. We should therefore claim in the name of tolerance the right not to tolerate the intolerant. We should claim that any movement preaching intolerance places itself outside the law. And we should consider incitement to intolerance and persecution as criminal. In the same way, we consider incitement to murder or kidnapping or the revival of the slave trade as criminal. The radical Christian right, these dominionists, have no religious legitimacy. This is a mass political movement. It ignores the core values of the Christian religion, summed up by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, and the core values of American democracy. They are, as the late Reverend William Sloan Coffin pointed out, not biblical literalists, as they claim, but selective literalists, choosing the bits and pieces of the Bible that conform to their ideology and ignoring, distorting, and making up the rest. The rapture, for example, the cornerstone of their end-time eschatology, is not in the Bible. There is enough hatred, bigotry, and lust for violence in the pages of the Bible to satisfy any tyrant bent on justifying cruelty and violence as being biblically sanctioned. Religion, as Reinhold Niebuhr knew, is a good thing for good people and a bad thing for bad people. But the suppositions of the biblical writers, who understood little about the working of the cosmos or the human body, are so fanciful and the accounts so wild that even biblical literalists reject them. God is not, as many writers of the Bible believed, peering down on us through little peepholes in the sky called stars. And the selective literalist cannot have it both ways. The Bible is either all true, an impossibility, given that it frequently is at odds with itself, and its most bizarre edicts must be obeyed, or it must be read in another way. Liberal Christians who can cherry-pick the Bible to create a Jesus and a God that is always loving and compassionate have to face the fact that there are also hateful passages in the Bible that bolster the rage, self-aggrandizement, and intolerance of the Christian right. These passages have been used to sanctify persecution in the past, whether during the murderous reign of the Emperor Constantine, the Inquisition, or the Salem witch trials. What is heretical is not that such passages exist, but that they are taken out of context and used to give sacred authority to hateful political, and social creeds. Plato and Aristotle not only defended slavery, but often attacked Athenian democracy. But this does not mean that they should not be read for their penetrating insights into political systems and ethics. Sigmund Freud understood little about love, viewed religion as infantile regression, and colored nearly every human motive through the lens of human sexuality. But at the same time, Freud gave us one of the most powerful windows and vocabularies into the workings of our subconscious. The Bible was written by numerous people over hundreds of years with wide and often varying agendas, some of which were morally indefensible. But within its pages are powerful passages that help illuminate our lives and our place before the mysteries of human existence. The Bible, even with all its quirks and contradictions, its moments of madness and hatred, its mythologies of suns being halted in the skies, 90-year-old women giving birth, and men rising from the dead, informs my life. It is what led me to write this book. I too struggle, like the writers of the Bible, to understand. I too often get it wrong. But it is the honesty of the search, the doubts and the reverses, the mistakes and regrets, the effort to stand up and keep trying, that ultimately defines belief. It is not the certainty and self-righteousness, the tired and opaque cliche that Jesus is my personal Lord and Savior. This humility before the unknowable makes possible self-criticism, self-awareness, self-possession, and self-reflection. It makes possible a diverse human community. Dr. James Luther Adams, my ethics professor at Harvard Divinity School, told us that when we were his age, he was then close to 80, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists. The warning, given to me 25 years ago, came at the moment Pat Robertson and other radio and televangelists began speaking about a new political religion that would direct its efforts at taking control of all institutions, including mainstream denominations and the government. Its stated goal was to use the United States to create a global Christian empire. It was hard at the time to take such fantastic rhetoric seriously, especially given the buffoonish quality of those who expounded it. But Adams warned us against the blindness caused by intellectual snobbery. The Nazis, he said, were not going to return with swastikas and brown shirts. Their ideological inheritors had found a mask for fascism in patriotism and the pages of the Bible. Adams was not a man to use the word fascist lightly. He was in Germany in 1935 and 1936 and worked with the underground anti-Nazi church known as the Confessing Church, led by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Adams was eventually detained and interrogated by the Gestapo, who suggested he might want to consider returning to the United States. It was a suggestion he followed. He left on a night train with framed portraits of Adolf Hitler placed over the contents inside his suitcase. To hide the rolls of home movie film, he took of the so-called German Christian Church, which was pro-Nazi, and the few individuals who defied them, including the theologians Karl Barth and Albert Schweitzer. The ruse worked when the border police lifted the top of the suitcases, saw the portraits of the Führer, and closed them up again. I watched hours of the grainy black and white films as he narrated in his apartment in Cambridge. Adams saw in the Christian right, long before we did, disturbing similarities with the German Christian Church and the Nazi Party. Similarities that he said would, in the event of prolonged social instability or a national crisis, see American fascists, under the guise of religion, rise to dismantle the open society. He despaired of liberals, who, he said, as in Nazi Germany, mouthed platitudes about dialogue and inclusiveness that made them ineffectual and impotent. Liberals, he said, did not understand the power and allure of evil, nor the cold reality of how the world worked. The hand-wringing by Democrats with many asking how they can reach out to a movement whose leaders brand them as demonic and satanic, would not have surprised Adams. Like Bonhoeffer, he did not believe that those would fight effectively in coming times of turmoil, a fight that for him was an integral part of the biblical message, would come from the church or the liberal secular elite. His critique of the prominent research universities, along with the media, was no less withering. These institutions, self-absorbed, compromised by their close relationship with government and corporations, given enough of the pie to be complacent, were unwilling to deal with the fundamental moral questions and inequities of the age. They had no stomach for a battle that might cost them their prestige and comfort. He told me, I suspect, half in jest, that if the Nazis took over America, 60% of the Harvard faculty would begin their lectures with a Nazi salute. But this, too, was not an abstraction. He had watched academics at the University of Heidelberg, including the philosopher Martin Heidegger, raise their arms stiffly to students before class. Adams also reminded us that American intellectuals and industrialists openly flirted with fascism in the 1930s. Mussolini's corporatism, which created an unchecked industrial and business aristocracy, appealed to many American industrialists at the time, who saw it as an effective counterweight to the New Deal. In 1934, Fortune magazine lavished praise on the Italian dictator for his defanging of labor unions and his empowerment of industrialists at the expense of workers. Adams finally told us to watch closely what the Christian right did to homosexuals. He had seen how the Nazis had used values to launch state repression of opponents. Hitler, days after he took power in 1933, imposed a ban on all homosexual organizations. He ordered raids on places where homosexuals gathered, culminating with the ransacking of the Institute for Sexual Science in Berlin. Thousands of volumes from the Institute's library were tossed that May into a bonfire. Adams said that homosexuals would be the first deviants singled out by the Christian right. We would be the next. The ban on same-sex marriages passed by 11 states was part of this march towards our door. A 1996 federal law already defines marriage as between a man and a woman. All of the states with ballot measures, with the exception of Oregon, had already outlawed same-sex marriages, as do 27 other states. The bans, however, had to be passed. Believers were told to thwart activist judges who wanted to overturn them. The Christian family, even the nation, was under threat. The ban served to widen the splits tearing apart the country. The attacks on homosexuals handed to the foot soldiers of the Christian right an easy, vulnerable target. It gave them a taste of victory. It made them feel empowered. But it is ominous for gays and for us. 2 decades later, even in the face of the growing reach of the Christian right, Adams' prediction seems apocalyptic. And yet the power brokers in the Christian right have moved from the fringes of society to the executive branch, the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the courts. The movement has all but seized control of the Republican Party. 45 senators and 186 members of the House of Representatives earned between an 80 to 100% approval rating from the 3 most influential Christian right advocacy groups, the Christian Coalition, Eagle Forum, and Family Resource Council. And the radical Christian right is seeking to take control of military chaplaincies, which now sees them holding roughly 50% of chaplaincy appointments in the armed services and the service academies. This is part of a much larger effort to politicize the military and law enforcement. This effort signals the final and perhaps most deadly stage in the long campaign by the radical Christian right to dismantle America's open society and build a theocratic state. A successful politicization of the military would signal the end of our democracy. During the past 2 years, I repeatedly listened to radical preachers attack as corrupt and godless most American institutions, from federal agencies that provide housing and social welfare to public schools and the media. But there were 2 institutions that never came under attack: the military and law enforcement. While these preachers had no interest in communicating with local leaders of other faiths or those in the community who did not subscribe to their call for a radical Christian state, they assiduously courted and flattered the military and police. They held special services and appreciation days for all four branches of the armed services and for various law enforcement agencies. They encouraged their young men and women to enlist or to join the police or state troopers. They sought out sympathetic military and police officials to attend church events, where these officials were lauded and feted for their Christian probity and patriotism. They painted the war in Iraq not as an occupation, but as an apocalyptic battle by Christians against Islam, a religion they regularly branded as satanic. All this befits a movement whose final aesthetic is violence. It also befits a movement that in the end would need the military and police to hold power in American society. The movement is building a Praetorian Guard, referring to the paramilitary force that defied legal constraints, made violence part of the political discourse, and eventually plunged ancient Rome into tyranny and despotism. They need a paramilitary force that operates outside the law, one that sows fear among potential opponents and is capable of physically silencing those branded by their leaders as traitors. It is a vital instrument in the hands of despotic movements, communist and fascist movements during the last century, each built paramilitary forces that operated beyond the reach of the law. Eric Prince, the secretive mega-millionaire, right-wing Christian founder of Blackwater, the private security firm that has built a formidable mercenary force in Iraq, champions his company as a patriotic extension of the U.S. military. His employees, in an act as cynical as it is deceitful, take an oath of loyalty to the Constitution. These mercenary units in Iraq, including Blackwater, contain some 25,000 fighters. They unleash indiscriminate and wanton violence against unarmed Iraqis and are beyond the reach of legitimate authority. The appearance of these paramilitary fighters, heavily armed and wearing their trademark black uniforms, patrolling the streets of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, gave us a grim taste of the future. It was a stark reminder that the tyranny we impose on others, we will one day impose on ourselves. The politicization of the military, the fostering of the belief that violence must be used to further a peculiar ideology rather than defend a democracy, was on display recently when Air Force and Army generals and colonels filmed in uniform at the Pentagon appeared in a promotional video distributed by Christian Embassy, a radical Washington-based organization dedicated to building a Christian America. Dan Cooper, an undersecretary of Veterans Affairs, says in the video that his weekly prayer sessions are more important than doing the job. Major General Jack Catton says that his being an advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff is a wonderful opportunity to evangelize men and women setting defense policy. My first priority is my faith, he says. I think it's a huge impact. You have many men and women who are seeking God's counsel and wisdom as they advise the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense. The group has burrowed deep inside the Pentagon. It hosts weekly Bible sessions with senior officers, by its own count, some 40 generals, and weekly prayer breakfast each Wednesday from 7 to 7:50 a.m. in the executive dining room, as well as numerous outreach events, in the words of the organization, to share and sharpen one another in their quest to bridge the gap between faith and work. If the United States falls into a period of instability caused by another catastrophic terrorist attack, an economic meltdown, or a series of environmental disasters, these paramilitary forces, protected and assisted by fellow ideologues in the police and military, could swiftly abolish what is left of our eroding democracy. War with the huge profits it hands to businesses and right-wing interests that often help bankroll the Christian right could become a permanent condition. And the thugs with automatic weapons, black uniforms, and wraparound sunglasses who appeared on the streets in New Orleans could appear on our streets. In a moment of crisis, I expect a popular backlash, but it will, I fear, be a right-wing backlash. a frightened and enraged populace could turn to the very forces that have orchestrated this desperation and ask them to save them. The radical Christian right calls for exclusion, cruelty, and intolerance in the name of God. Its members do not commit evil for evil's sake. They commit evil to make a better world. To attain this better world, they believe some must suffer and be silenced. And at the end of time, all those who oppose them must be destroyed. The worst human suffering in history has been carried out by those who preach such grand utopian visions, those who seek to implant by force their narrow, particular goodness. This is true for all doctrines of personal salvation, from Christianity to ethnic nationalism, to communism, to fascism. Dreams of a universal good create hells of persecution, suffering, and slaughter. No human being could ever be virtuous enough to attain such dreams, and the earth has swallowed millions of hapless victims in the vain pursuit of a new heaven and a new earth. Ironically, it is idealism that leads radical fundamentalists to strip human beings of their dignity and their sanctity and turn them into abstractions. Yet it is only by holding on to the sanctity of each individual, each human life, only by placing our faith in tiny, unheroic acts of compassion and kindness that we survive as a community and as individual human beings. Hope has two beautiful daughters, Augustine wrote. Their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they do not remain the way they are. Anger when directed against those who would abuse the weak, preach bigotry and injustice, trample on the poor, crush dissent, and impose a religious tyranny is a blessing. Read the prophets. But because so many of our institutions are bankrupt, bought off by corporate dollars, and no longer willing to accept in religious terms that heretics exist, the goal is to appease the very people who call for our destruction. The liberal church stumbles along, muttering creeds it no longer believes, trying to peddle a fuzzy, feel-good theology that distorts and ignores the Bible as much as the Christian right. The Christian right at least understands the ills of American society, even as they use these ills to plunge us into tyranny. The most potent opposition to the movement will rise, I expect, from within the evangelical tradition. And the movement fears Christians who have remained loyal to the core values of the gospel, who delineate between right and wrong, who are willing to be vilified and attacked in the name of a higher good, and who have the courage to fight back. We must begin to support those isolated groups and individuals who at some cost are fighting back, the clergy and rabbis who have banded together in Ohio to challenge in court the tax-exempt status of the megachurches that peddle this ideology and promote Christian candidates. The independent judges, such as the Republican-appointed judge in Dover, Pennsylvania, who banned the teaching of creationism in the public school because it is mythology, not science. As well as Cardinal Roger Mahoney, the head of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, the nation's largest, who called on Catholics to be prepared to defy current efforts in Congress, backed by the Christian right, to make it a felony to shield or protect or offer support to illegal immigrants. The bill before Congress would expand the definition of alien smuggling to theoretically include working in a soup kitchen, driving a friend to a bus stop, or caring for a neighbor's child. It would make mercy, compassion, and charity for the least among us a federal crime. There are two solutions left. We can begin to fight the corporate state to redirect our national wealth and resources to fund a massive anti-poverty campaign and curb the cycle of perpetual war that enriches the military-industrial complex and, by extension, the two political parties that dominate Washington. Or we can accept an inevitable Christo-fascism backed by these corporations. Don't expect glib democratic politicians to address these issues. They are, as Ralph Nader understands, hostage to corporate money. George Bush is the worst president in American history. If Al Gore or John Kerry had the spine to take him on, to challenge corporate welfare, corporate crime, the hundreds of billions of dollars in corporate bailouts, and issues such as labor law reform, if either had actually stood up to these corporate behemoths on behalf of the working and middle class, rather than mutter thought-terminating cliches about American greatness, they could have won in a landslide. But they did not dare to piss off their corporate paymasters. These corporations and their enraged and manipulated followers in the Christian right, tens of millions of them, if left unchecked, will propel us into despotism. The corporate state has rigged our system, hollowed out our political process, and steadily stripped citizens of constitutional rights, federal and state protection and assistance. It is a coup d'etat in slow motion. Edward Luttwak, the conservative historian, says that if current trends continue, the United States will be a third world country by 2020. This may be the twilight of American democracy. And it is better to stand up and fight, even in vain, than not to fight at all. Any support for a political candidate unwilling to challenge the corporate state is a wasted vote, even if this means to opt out of the two-party system. In Mark Twain's book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, it ends with Huck facing the moral dilemma we face, whether to pay homage to a false moral and legal code or damn ourselves in the eyes of many by opposing it. So I was full of trouble, full as I could be, and didn't know what to do. At last I had an idea and I says, I'll go and write the letter and then see if I can pray. Why, it was astonishing, the way I felt as light as a feather right straight off, and my troubles all gone. So I got a piece of paper and a pencil, all glad and excited, and sat down and wrote, Miss Watson, your runaway Negro Jim is down here 2 miles below Pikesville, and Mr. Phelps has got him and will give him up for the reward if you send Huck Finn. I felt good and all washed clean of sin for the first time I had ever felt so in my life, and I knowed I could pray now. But I didn't do it straight off, but laid the paper down and sat there thinking, thinking how good it was all this happened so, and how near I come to being lost and going to hell. And went on thinking, and got to thinking over our trip down the river, and I see Jim before me all the time, in the day and in the nighttime, sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms, and we a floating along, talking and singing and laughing. But somehow I couldn't seem to strike no places to harden me against him, but only the other kind. I'd see him standing my watch on top of his'n, instead of calling me so I could go on sleeping, and see him how glad he was when I come back out of the fog, and when I come to him again in the swamp up there where the feud was and such like times, and would always call me honey and pet me and do everything he could think of for me, and how good he always was. And at last I struck the time I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard. And he was so grateful and said I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world and the only one he's got now. And then I happened to look around and see that paper. It was a close place. I took it up and held it in my hand. I was a-trembling because I'd got to decide forever betwixt two things, and I knowed it. I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then says to myself, all right then, I'll go to hell, and tore it up. I do not deny the right of these Christian radicals to be, to believe and worship as they choose. But I will not engage in a dialogue with those who deny my right to be, who delegitimize my faith and denounce my struggle before God as worthless. All dialogue must include respect and tolerance for the belief, worth, and dignity of others, including those outside the nation and the faith. When this respect is denied, it is no longer a difference of opinion. It is a fight for survival. This movement seeks, in the name of Christianity and American democracy, to destroy that which it claims to defend. I do not believe that America will inevitably become a fascist state, or that the Christian right is the Nazi party. But I do believe that the Christian right is a sworn and potent enemy of the open society. Its ideology bears within it the seeds of a religious fascism. In the event of a crisis, the movement stands poised to ruthlessly reshape America in ways that have not been seen since the nation's founding. All Americans, not only those of faith, must learn to speak about this movement with a new vocabulary, to give up passivity, and to defend tolerance. The attacks by this movement on the rights and beliefs of Muslims, Jews, immigrants, gays, lesbians, women, scholars, scientists, those they dismiss as nominal Christians, and those they brand with a curse of secular humanist, is an attack on all of us, on our values, our religious freedoms, and our democracy. Tolerance is a virtue, but tolerance, coupled with passivity, is a vice. Thank you.